We're live and we're local. This is a Juno Afternoon on Wednesday, August 23rd. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. On today's show, we'll hear about Cordova's Fungus Festival. Chris Taylor will be here to highlight UAS art classes. We'll find out about Saturday's fundraiser for Amy Henderson. And Tlingit Language instructor Lance Twitchell will be here to talk about his upcoming class. And finally, we'll talk about Sunday's Peace Rally. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more coming up next right here on a Juno Afternoon. Taking a look at weather for the rest of today, scattered rain showers, highs around 60. And tomorrow, scattered rain showers, highs around 60. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous people were among crowds outside the Phoenix Convention Center Tuesday protesting President Trump's visit to Arizona. Nolan Tyke was with the group, which included people from different tribes. She says they gathered together to show opposition of the Trump administration and advocate for indigenous issues.
To come in unity because we feel that these political leaders in this country right now are not right for the people, and we as indigenous people are the first that should be having our voice heard, and we're here in spiritual prayers and as one people for nonviolent, but to come together for unity and to make sure that this country goes in good hands for the future of our generations.
Tyke was there representing the Apache Stronghold, a group which works to protect sacred sites, including Oak Flat, from development.
This leader right now that's here and for our country, he will not protect our future generations. And that's where I want my voice to be heard.
Some Native people in the state are also concerned with ending Indian mascots and logos and oppose the administration's plan to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. Cher Thomas is with the group Arizona Stands, which helped organize the march.
There are certain rights and dignities that we are currently being denied, and that especially goes back to our traditional land. There's a lot of issues in Arizona regarding land, and some of these things are impacted directly by the policies of the administration and also by certain executive orders that are being loomed over our head as some kind of weird threat.
Meanwhile, inside the convention center, Trump rallied supporters and commented on a number of areas, including the enforcement of immigration laws, border issues, and blasted journalists, calling the press dishonest. The company which built the Dakota Access Pipeline filed suit against Greenpeace and other environmental groups Tuesday, alleging they disseminated false information and interfered with construction. Reporter Bree Ripley has more.
Texas-based Energy Transfer Partners alleges that the group's actions opposing the pipeline interfered with business, incited violence, and facilitated crimes and acts of terrorism. The company says activists targeted financial institutions that backed the project and violated racketeering and defamation laws. The pipeline was delayed for months due to legal wrangling and on-the-ground protests by tribes and groups that fear environmental harm. The lawsuit filed in federal court in North Dakota seeks damages that could approach $1 billion. Greenpeace attorney Tom Wetterer said in a recorded statement that the lawsuit is meritless and alleges this is a second consecutive year that President Trump's attorneys have singled out the organization. Energy Transfer Partners is represented by Kasowitz Benson Torres LLP, a law firm whose managing partner, Mark Kasowitz, is President Donald Trump's longtime personal attorney.
It's yet another classic strategic lawsuit against public participation, or a SLAP.
A SLAP is intended to censor groups of people by hampering their efforts, or what Wetterer refers to as Greenpeace's legitimate advocacy work, with expensive and time-consuming litigation.
What this has become is a pattern of harassment by corporate bullies, with Trump's attorneys leading the way.
The 1,200-mile pipeline began moving North Dakota oil through South Dakota and Iowa to a distribution point in Illinois June 1st. For National Native News, I'm Bree Ripley in Billings, Montana.
The Chickasaw Nation in Oklahoma is hosting a series of legal classes in the next couple weeks and in September for class members in the Indian Trust Cobell settlement. The clinics will assist Chickasaw citizens and other Native Americans with information and deadlines for a payment in November. The historic lawsuit settles individual claims in the billions over the mismanagement of Indian Trust by the U.S. government. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations. And by the law offices of Sanofsky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Monkman, a national tribal rights law firm with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're tuned into a Juno Afternoon, and I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. Our first guests are going to be talking to us about the Cordova Fungus Festival. We're just having a little bit of technical difficulties with the phone line, so I'm going to put on bird note, and we'll be right back with that interview.
This is bird note. Put up a nectar feeder for hummingbirds, and you may soon enjoy the thrill of the tiny gems hovering right outside your windows. But you might also entice other birds that have a sweet tooth. Have you seen a larger bird dipping its sharp bill into your hummingbird feeder? It's probably an oriole. You're most likely to see Baltimore and orchard orioles in the east, and bullocks or hooded orioles in the west. These birds, whose bright colors spice up our summer, spend their winters in the tropics, where they often drink nectar from flowers. The same goes for smaller birds, like Tennessee warblers, often seen at flowers during migration. But many birds shun nectar. Birds need the enzyme sucrase in their bodies in order to digest the sucrose of nectar, and most simply don't have enough. Scientists think birds that can readily digest sugar, like warblers, have an adaptive advantage. When they fly to the tropics for the colder months, they can tap into sources of sugar that other birds just can't handle. That sweet tooth, it turns out, is important to their survival. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
You're tuned into a Juno Afternoon. It's just about 8 minutes after the hour. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and with me on the line are my first guests to talk about putting the fun in fungus at the Cordova Fungus Festival. Welcome to the show. I think I've got on the line. Oh, sorry. There we go. Now I got you guys on there. Sorry about that.
Okay,
you guys are on the air. I'm here with some folks who are involved with the Cordova Fungus Festival. So welcome to the show. Thanks for being here. I'm going to first let you guys introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about how you're connected to the festival.
Thanks. My name is Kathy Renfeld, and I'm the executive director of the Cordova Chamber of Commerce.
I am Melissa Gabrielson, and I am a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Forest Service.
And I'm Kinsey Jesta. I'm the programs coordinator for Copper River Prince William Sound Marketing Association.
Great. Well, thanks again for being here today. Let's start with hearing a little bit about the festival, which you guys contacted us because you consider this festival to be a little bit of a hidden gem, and you think maybe you need to get the word out statewide about what it is, what it's all about. So, Kathy, would you like to start by giving us a little bit of overview of the festival, when it is and what activities are planned?
Sure. So Cordova Fungus Festival, it happens every year in the fall. This year it's September 1st through 3rd, 2017. So it's basically just 3 days of getting out and enjoying the fungus and lichen and the natural world here in Cordova. We do that with guided forest forays, which is like a guided hike where you go and forage for mushrooms with an expert to kind of guide and show you which mushrooms are edible and which ones are poisonous or maybe not so delicious to eat and ones that can be used for other things. And then there's also kids activities, getting the little ones into the the national forest and feet on the ground and getting their hands dirty is a big goal of ours for festival as well. We also have art and craft related events. One of our partners, the Netloft, has an array of handcrafting activities, and some other of our partners, Wonka Cultural Center for one, is going to be doing a bare bread painting class. And then there's going to be some food events as well. There's a mushroom recipe swap. There's some classes. There's mushroom, it's called Fungus 101 and Fungus 102. They're just basic mushroom identification classes, and they're open for kids and adults. And then one thing that I'm excited about, there's going to be mushrooms and folklore storytelling and lecture. That's going to be a neat activity. And then there'll also be a wild harvest feast on Saturday night. Most of these activities are free, and the only thing you need to do is just register online for the festival, and you can just show up and check in when you get here, and then you can go to all these events for free. The only ones that have a cost associated to cover the cost of putting on these events are the Netloft handcrafting events and the Alonka Cultural Center event, and then the Wild Harvest Feast is a fundraiser, and so that is going to be on Saturday night, and that benefits not only the Copper River Watershed Project, which is one of our festival partners. It's a nonprofit locally, but it also benefits the festival.
Well, that all sounds great. It's a lot. It's so much. I had no idea all that was going on. How about a little bit of history or background about the festival? Melissa, would you like to tell us a bit about that?
Sure, I can. So the Cordova Fungus Festival was started about 11 years ago now. And it was predominantly started because people in the community were wanting to know more about mushrooms. And as you can imagine, I mean, myself included, you know, growing up, I didn't really know much about mushrooms. You're kind of scared of them. You know, they're really hard to identify. And the Forest Service thought, well, man, what can we do to get people to become more familiar with these, you know, the fungus and stuff that are out there and not be so afraid of them, and to educate them about, you know, the array of things that are out in the forest and to get people out in the forest. And so they started the Fungus Festival to kind of get people out into the forest and talking and thinking about the forest and sustainability and what's out there and what they can be using in their everyday life, whether it's for cooking or if you want to be using them for medicinal purposes or what have you. And so that's the main reason why the festival was started. And as it progressed, we started to rope in all these other partners that have been really, really amazing in kind of incorporating, you know, the foraging aspect and the importance of the ecosystem, that it's not just about fungus, it's also about our forests, it's also about our salmon, and bringing all these people in. And we also made a Mushroom of the National Forest in Alaska guide, which incorporates mushrooms that are found in both the Chugach and the Tongass forests. So that guide is available to anyone who has a Forest Service station near them, and they can pick one up, and that's really helpful with identification.
Wow, that's so interesting. So that was all you guys, huh?
Yeah.
cool. So it sounds like this festival is a pretty big deal. How important is it to Cordova's culture? Is this an annual event that everybody gets pretty excited about? Maybe Kinsey wants to take this one, talk a little bit about that.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, you know, coastal Alaska is definitely a deeply seasonal place. And Cordova specifically, we're the home port for the Copper River Fishing Fleet. And so everything kind of goes along with that schedule. You know, town lives and breathes by the seasons. And this time of year is harvest season for, of course, the fungus, our wild berries, and it's also our coho run is happening right now, and it'll run into September. So I think this time of year everyone gets really excited about adding all the goodies to their freezer and getting out and enjoying the forest and the ocean.
Yeah, well, you know, all this talk about food and festivals is making me kind of hungry. I understand the festival includes the dinner. Would you tell us a little bit about what's on the menu?
You know, the chef that is coming, he owns a restaurant called Rye in McKinney, Texas. And he's an accoladed chef. We're really excited to have him here. He lived across the street from one of our fishermen and heard the story about Copper River salmon and wild abundance and harvesting sustainable foods up here in Alaska. Got really excited about that because that's his restaurant's focus, is local seasonal foods.
And he formed a relationship with that fisherman, and now he's going to come up and cook for us. He's been pretty vague about what's on the menu, like any good chef, right? He wants to whet your appetite.
Game day decisions.
But I have been told that it is a seasonal Alaskan menu with a Texas flair.
Wow, Tex-Alaska. I like it. That sounds great. Well, we talked a lot about how this festival is connected with the seasons and the wild abundance that occurs in Cordova. Kathy, would you like to say a little bit about the economic impact of the festival and how it relates to stewardship of the ecology?
Sure. So, you know, in Cordova, the Chamber and the Forest Service and a lot of the partners that are involved in this event actually are partners for several events and festivals that we have throughout the year. We kind of have one for each season. In the spring, we have Shorebird Festival, and in the winter, there's Iceworm Festival, and in the summer, there's Salmon Festival, and so here in the fall with our Fungus Festival, a lot of it is always about getting people out, enjoying the natural world, seeing these connections being made, and really increasing the knowledge and the environmental literacy of the people that come to the event, teaching them sustainable harvest techniques, helping them get out with a guide, because some people might not feel comfortable going out on their own the first time to go and enjoy these things. And so there's definitely an aspect of this that has to do with educating adults and kids about the environment in which they're already living and how all of these things are connected. You know, a healthy forest is you can often measure that by how healthy the fungus is in the forest. But a healthy forest can't be a healthy forest without a healthy ocean. When those salmon swim upstream and they leave their carcasses on the stream bank, that goes and provides nutrients that are spread throughout the entire forest. The fungus is actually one of the main vehicles by which those nutrients are spread all over the forest, and that's something that we're really excited to help people understand, the whole interconnectedness of everything. So that's one of the main impacts of this festival in our community, and there's also an economic impact of all these festivals, and we've been trying to measure that in different ways. We actually, one way that we're doing is we're having a festival raffle, and the way that you get entries into the festival raffle is that you go out and you spend money in the community. So if you want to, if you need some bug repellent, you go into the store and you show them that you're with the festival. You have a little festival pin. And if you buy it during festival, then you get a little fungus buck, and then you can turn that over and write your name on it, and it becomes an entry into the festival raffle. And so it's really neat. It's a way, kind of like a win-win-win. The people that are here for the festival, enjoying the festival, get an entry into the festival raffle without really doing much of anything. The businesses get a win because they get people coming into their store and buying something. And there's a draw because the people that are coming to the festival know about these raffle tickets, these fungus bucks, and they want to get them. And it's a win for the chamber and the local community to have some way to measure and kind of record this impact so that later on we can say, wow, we made, you know, our community made $10,000 in 4 days from Shorebird Festival, you know, people who came to that festival alone. So, yeah, that's something new that we're starting to just kind of show that, yes, these events, they're great for many reasons. And one of them is that they're healthy for our local economy.
That sounds great. I can tell all three of you are really excited about this. If you're just joining me on a Juno afternoon, we're speaking with some folks from the who are representatives of the Cordova Fungus Festival. And Kathy, let's go over the details again before we wrap up. When and where is it taking place, and where can we find more information?
Yes, it's happening in Cordova, Alaska. It's from September 1st through 3rd, and it's going to be on our website would be CordovaFungusFestival.com, and on the website you can get the full festival schedule, you can get some more information about the speakers, and you can register for the festival right there. There's also a place there for you to sign up to volunteer. This festival is, as I mentioned earlier, most of the events are free, and this is a really volunteer-run festival, so we kind of are fueled by the energy of everyone else who's excited about this event as well. So that's all things that you can find right on our festival website, which is CordovaFungusFestival.com.
That sounds great. I know you guys have been working really hard. Kathy, anything else you'd like to add? I'll check in with each of you before we wrap up.
Nothing that I can think of. I just appreciate you bringing us on the air to talk to you about it today. We're excited to bring the fungus among us to everyone.
And Melissa, would you like to add anything?
I don't think so, but thank you very much for allowing us the time to speak about this festival. It's really fun, and it is something that we're really excited about.
Of course. And how about you, Kinsey, last but not least?
Yeah, I just want to say that although we celebrate this here in Cordova, I hope that all Alaskans are proud of our wild harvest and celebrate in their own way at home.
That's a great sentiment to end on. Thank you again, all three, for being here today and for getting the word out about the Cordova Fungus Festival.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after this break.
Hi, this is Carol Ann from the Haines Visitor Center inviting you to the Southeast Conference's annual meeting, September 19th to the 21st. That's right, it's in Haines this year, and we can't wait to welcome the region's policymakers, businesses, nonprofits, and community members. This year's theme is Navigating the Southeast Economy. Find out more about the 2017 Southeast Conference annual meeting at seconference.org.
It's just about 23 minutes after the hour. You're tuned into a Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney, and my next guest is Chris Taylor. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you.
Chris, you have a long association with the Canvas, but you're also an adjunct at UAS. How long have you been doing that?
I think I've been out at UAS teaching classes for about 5 years.
5 years? Wow. Yeah. That's great. And you're here to talk about some art classes, but before we get into that, I just wanted to ask a couple of questions about yourself. What kind of art do you enjoy the most?
I'm a pretty big fan of most art. I love the abstract expressionists. I love classical work.
Painting, sculptures,
painting,
photography.
Mostly 2D. And I do love sculpture. I appreciate it. I think I wish I was a sculptor, to be honest. But mostly 2D art is where I spend most of my time studying and hitting museums and galleries looking at that.
Well, it's never too late to get your career as a sculptor off the ground. Have you seen any exhibits lately that you especially liked?
I was just trying to remember. I was in Portland about a month ago, and they had some fantastic work. I'd never been to that museum before, and I really enjoyed their collection. They had a beautiful exhibit of prints and watercolors that I thought were fantastic, and I cannot remember the name of the artist that I was looking at. Sometimes I get a little bit more focused on the than the image than the artist, but I enjoyed that museum quite a bit.
Cool. Shout out to that museum. Mm-hmm. And you're an artist yourself. Have you exhibited around town or around the state around the nation?
Yeah, just I've showed quite a bit down south. And then just recently in February, I had a solo show at the Canvas, which was a mixture of some large-scale paintings that I'd recently finished and then a lot of drawings, mostly figurative, some abstracted still lifes. And then had a pop-up show a couple months later at the Amalga Distillery, showing some more drawings and some paintings. So I show pretty regularly, yeah.
Cool. And how would you describe your work?
I'd say that, I was trained classically, representational realistic art, but my work is kind of a hybrid of that, a little, I guess I'd say, semi-abstract, mostly figurative, so dealing with the human body. A lot of charcoal, oil painting, large-scale oil paintings. So.
Cool. I do admit that I went online and looked up some of your work. It's really, really beautiful.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right, so tell us a bit about the classes that you're going to be leading at the University of Alaska Southeast.
Well, they're great classes. The first one that I'll talk about is the beginning drawing class. It's a class I've taught the most, and I love the class. It's my philosophy with art is that everybody should do it, and that I think everybody can learn to draw. So we focus a ton on just the foundations. So the basic structure is, learning how to see is a big deal when doing art. So how to break things down visually, understand what you're seeing, practicing eye-hand coordination, and then just learning the fundamentals of how light falls on an object. So we do focus predominantly on representational drawing, what you're seeing, and drawing from observation. It's a lot of fun, and I've had a lot of great success and a lot of awesome students go through, and some great work come up from that class.
They draw from a model or
No,
objects?
So in the beginning drawing class, we focus predominantly on still life drawing. So, keep it simple, and it really just helps. Once you get these foundations down, then you're pretty much ready to draw anything. You know, you just need, in the advanced drawing class, we really dive into the figure predominantly. So in the beginning drawing, I just like to really build that strong, solid foundation so people can walk out and be able to draw what they see and conquer the figure if they wish to go further. Yeah.
Fantastic. So when do these classes start?
The classes start this coming week on Tuesday.
Wow,
yeah, so
that's
just
great.
A few days away, yeah.
Are you all ready with your syllabus and everything?
I'm ready to go, yeah.
That's great. You look ready. And how long, what's the duration of the course? Is it all semester?
Yeah, it's all semester.
Okay.
So it's 15 weeks. And the beginning drawing class is on Tuesday and Thursday nights from 5:30 to 8:00. The advanced drawing class, which focuses mostly on the figure, that's going to be Monday, Wednesday, 5:30 to 8:00. So they're both evening classes.
And these classes are open to the public. They're not just for UAS students.
I believe so, yeah. I have had quite a few non-degree-seeking students that take the course just because they want to learn to draw and they have some extra time. And then I have degree-seeking students and students in other degrees, not just focusing on art. So,
and where's the best place to find out more information?
On the UAS website is the best place to go, and that is www.uaonline.alaska.edu. And they can also call the enrollment office 907-796-6100.
Cool. Well, that sounds great. Best of luck with the classes.
Thank you very much.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, this is great. Just get the word out and get some people drawn.
Sure. Yeah, happy to do that. Well, thanks for being here with us today, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
You're tuned into a Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney, and my next guests here are KJ Metcalf and Luann McVeigh. And they're here to talk about a gathering this Sunday. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So this Sunday is a unity rally, and you're part of the organization, and it's Juno's response to Charlottesville. So I wanted to just ask you both, where were you when you heard the news about what had happened in Charlottesville, and what was your reaction?
Well, I was just stunned, and people started asking, are we going to do anything in Juno? And that's really what prompted this coalition to come together rather quickly to plan this. And we looked at possible times, and it seemed like this Sunday, 2 to 3:30 was an appropriate time. And so we have really pulled a large group from the community to help plan it. And Luann, why don't you talk about some of the details?
Okay. Yes, some of the things that are happening on Sunday, it'll all be in the Marine Park shelter, but we expect to have an invocation by Tlingit Kusti, the Tlingit Way of Life dancers, and we're looking forward to that greatly. Bruce Botello will be moderating, as we have some speakers, including our mayor, Ken Kelch, also including our state writer laureate, Ernestine Hayes, and UAS professor Sol Neely. Also, Ishmael Hope will be sharing a poem that he's written, and other members of Juno People for Peace and Justice will also be speaking to address questions of unity and concerns about the violence, especially, that we've seen in Charlottesville and elsewhere in response to hatred demonstrations.
And who would you like to see come to this gathering? Who should come?
We'd love it if everyone who is concerned about violence and racism and white supremacy as well in our community. We'd like to see everyone who's thought about it and who's wondering what we can all do about it come and show their support.
I think it's an opportunity for Juno to have its voice heard. And one of the things we're asking folks is, what is it specifically that they can do to promote peace and justice and nonviolence? What one thing can they do?
We're looking for an introspective time for many people. I think it will result in a lot of self-reflection and thinking about how racism and discrimination have played in our lives and what we can do to help ourselves to be better people and reach out to others in a more constructive, unified way.
What would you like to see happen as an outcome of this rally?
Well, I think Luann probably really nailed it there, that we'd like people to think about what is it that they can do, what action, what changes in their life, what thing might they do that they hadn't thought of that would help promote peace and justice in our community. We have a number of issues. I work with male prisoners, mostly prisoners who have an FASD, whose mothers drank during pregnancy. And so they're just overwhelmed by obstacles. And when they get out of prison, to think of the prejudice against them, they're felons. Many of them are Alaska Natives. And they have a brain disability for the most part. And their ability to survive in this community is very small. And so that's a justice issue. And there are so many others that we can talk about and that we can maybe begin to solve.
That sounds great. So you anticipate some discussion as part of this rally. The speakers, that will they be addressing some of the things that they believe people could change or couldn't? Will the speakers maybe make suggestions or say some things about that?
Yes, that's definitely part of what we'll expect to happen. But also we hope to have some open mic time so that folks can come up and share the things that come to their minds, you know, from being part of the audience and thinking about our own lives and how we might change our own actions to support others in better ways.
That sounds fantastic. So if you're just joining me, my guests are KJ Metcalf and Luann McVeigh. They're here to talk about the Unity Rally this Sunday from 2 to 3:30 at Marine Park. Where can we find out more information about this event?
If you check the Juno People for Peace and Justice Facebook page, there's a short summary on a poster there, and that will let you know. And if you'd like to come and join us, we're going to be doing our last-minute planning at 5:15 today at Northern Light Church. And we'd love to have additional people. If you've got the urge to be part of this, we'd love to have you.
Well, that's about an hour and a half. What else would you two like to add?
Well, I just think it's just a marvelous opportunity for people to come together. And we just have to do a better job of talking to each other, even though we may not agree on all the issues. But we'll find that we have many issues in common that we do agree on.
And you, Luann?
Yes, I'm just looking forward to a chance for our community to show that we really do care about events in Charlottesville and elsewhere in the world where we see violence or where we see discrimination and hatred, and we can make it a better place.
Well, thank you both very much for being here and for helping to organize this and put it on. I am deeply grateful for the work that you're doing, and I'm really glad that Juno is formulating something in response to what happened. So thank you both for speaking out, and thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks
for having us, Shelley.
You're very welcome.
You're leaving.
You're tuned into a Juno Afternoon. It's about 17 minutes to the top of the hour. I'm Shelley Delaney, and with me is my guest, Sila. She's here to talk about an upcoming fundraiser for Amy Henderson. Sila, who is Amy? Is she a friend of yours? What's your connection to Amy?
Yes, Amy's a family friend, and we're just trying to set up this fundraiser for her to help her with her medical cost.
Okay. Is there something in particular going on with Amy that you wanted to share?
Amy has cancer, and the cancer type that she has is called NUT midline carcinoma. It's a big word.
It is.
It's a very extremely rare and aggressive cancer. Only 20 to 30 are diagnosed each year in the United States. It is a very poor prognosis, only a few known survivors, and there's no treatment protocol for this type of cancer.
So, and what's Amy's role here in the community, and where does she work?
She works at the Lemon Creek Correctional Facility. Prior to that, she worked at Bartlett Hospital and Southeast Medical Clinic.
Okay. So it sounds like she's pretty well known.
Yes.
She gets out there and helps other people with their health problems, and this is our chance to help her with hers.
Yes, hopefully, yes.
What is the goal of the fundraiser?
Just to help with medical costs and support Amy while she fights this battle.
And she has family here in town, too?
Yes.
That's good. That's good. It's always good to be around family when that sort of thing happens.
Yes.
How can the community help out and show their support?
Just helping us buy tickets for our fundraiser this Saturday. We're hosting the fundraiser at the Filipino community from 5 to 8, and tickets are $20, and that will help go towards Amy's medical expense.
Where is the Filipino Community Center?
Yes, yes.
Where is that located?
I don't have their address, but we should know where the Filipino community is.
I think I know where it is. I think it's downtown on
downtown,
Franklin Street.
Downtown, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Franklin, yes.
Well, just, you know, sometimes, just in case somebody's listening who's new in town and might not know. Oh, that's great. So go over the details for me again. We know where it is now. When is it and what time?
It's on Saturday from 5 to 8. It's a dinner. It's a dinner, and we'll be serving adobo, pancit, rice, and salad. We'll have other things like door prize and a little bit of performance, 50-50, a lot of other silent auction things and stuff. So
a 50-50 raffle?
Yes.
Yeah, those are good. Those are good for bringing people out. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the fundraiser or about Amy? Just get people to come out?
No.
Keeping it short and simple, right?
Yeah.
Well, thanks for being here, Sila. And one last question. Where can we find out more information about it?
They can contact me. My phone number is 209-2952.
Okay, great. Area code 907?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thanks for being here today, for helping out your friend and getting the word out about the fundraiser. I know it's, you know, this kind of stuff can be overwhelming and sad and scary and expensive. So thanks for playing your role in it and helping her out and helping us let everybody know what's going on.
Thank you, and thank you for supporting us.
You're more than welcome.
In Alaska, the economy is changing.
We are not generating enough revenue to pay our daily bills.
The energy industry is changing, and so is the landscape.
You know, you appreciate things as they become diminished in your life, right? I mean, you look at them differently when they are disappearing.
Alaska's Energy Desk is following those changes from the state capital to the North Slope to the Kenai and then Alaska. Follow us on your local public radio station.
Like the river I've been running.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
It is about 10 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to A Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney, and I'm here with my last guest, last but not least, Lance Twitchell, Tlingit language instructor. Welcome to the show.
Ms. Cheese.
Oops, got you on the wrong mic there. Welcome to the show.
Goodness cheese.
So, Lance, you're a Tlingit language instructor. Are you also a native speaker?
I am a second language speaker. I'm a native Tlingit, Haida, and Yupik, but I'm a second language speaker. I started learning when I was about 20 years old.
And what do you love about speaking the language?
Well, the things I love about the language is primarily it connects me to people that I have talked to who have passed away. And so the first one I think of is my grandfather, Gush Dehin Silas Dennis. He was my first teacher. He was a lot of fun. We were deeply, deeply connected in this life. And when I lost him, it was a huge thing for me. And I was about in my early 20s. And so the language, holding on to the language, allowed me to hold on to him because I had memories of him beginning to teach me the language. And no one in our family really spoke it. And so it was a neat connection. And then as I learned more about just indigenous languages altogether, especially in North America, I realized there's this huge trend going on that we could actually reverse. And that trend is the loss of indigenous languages. And so and then once I met a cohort of people who are also have this desire to become speakers and that do become speakers, I realized it was something very special.
What a beautiful sentiment. How long did it take you to learn to speak Tlingit at the level you speak it at now?
Well, I've been at it for about 22 years. And I feel like maybe in another 22 years, I'll be pretty good. And so it's really interesting. I work with wonderful elders like Marge Dutson and George Davis and Nora Dauenhauer. And some of them are in their 90s. And I think, okay, 48 years from now, I'll be their age. And I wonder what things will even be like. And I wonder what I'll talk about. And just, you know, I'm assuming I could be 90 years old. And so it's really fun to talk with them and to think, no matter how much I study this language, I'll continue to try and say some things and I'll go to the speakers and they'll tell me and it'll be just, it's like a little revolution every time. You realize that there's a whole other way to see the world and there's multiple ways to see the world. But in this particular place, Tlingit Ani, Akukwan Ani, we're on the land of the Takukwan and the Akkwan people. And so when you can learn this language and utilize it, you also have this very special connection. And so I tell some of my students, I say, look out there, you're going to see something and you're going to call it by the name that people have been using for about 15,000 years in one particular place. And so for us, language is not just this new thing that's always changing. Our language is changing, but it's also deeply connected to this particular place.
I've heard Takukwan and Akkwan, and I think I understand the Ak part and the Taku part. What is the Kwan part?
Yeah, so Kwan is people of a place. So there'll usually be some place before it and then Kwan. And so Yakutat would be Yakutat, Yakutat Kwan. And so basically, if you thought of the Tlingit people, they're kind of divided into these groups. And so if you thought of Tlingit as a nation, these groups would be a Kwan, and they would be sort of like a state. And then within that state, you would have communities, and within those communities, you'd have clans and houses. And so one of the things, I think in English, it takes a long time and lots of drawings and everything. And same with kinship, the way that kinship works. It's very different in Tlingit than it is in English. So in English, you'd say, oh, yeah, that's your second cousin twice removed, and that one there is your father-in-law. And so you've got these certain terms that you know how to use. But in Tlingit, it's a different terminology, and it's one of those things that you can understand it when you learn the language. But to translate it, it gets a little bit – it gets murky. I mean, it's always possible, but it just gets a little murky.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Would you be willing to teach me another phrase or word right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, yeah. So let's start with – we're on the coast, so we'll start with two nouns, and then we'll learn one phrase. So our clans are divided into these two sides, and then there's these two birds that we see all over the place here in Southeast Alaska. One of them is a big black bird, and it likes to go caw, 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 and we call it yeish.
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 Yik a. And there's another one that's brown with a white head and a big yellow beak. And they both hang out by the dump a lot, and certainly in other places. And that one is ch-ok.
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 So, yeah, so Tlingit has about 58 sounds in it. I think there's about 25 of them that are not in the English language. There are four of them that we haven't found in any other language in the world. And so it has a really fun sound system. And so we like to really use the word fun and interesting in place of complicated or something. You know, because some people will say, boy, I can't say that. And my response is usually, well, you can. It just takes practice because you've never done that. And so when people go to learn how to do something new, especially a language, it's important for them to give themselves time and space, repetition, and to, you know, one of my friends, Roy Mitchell, he said, if you list five things on your hand that are the most important things in your life, shift one of those to your other hand and put language in its place. It has to be one of these top things in your life, or else you'll just have this kind of casual knowledge about it, but it'll be difficult for you to understand it and to speak it. So a good phrase is if you see somebody and you want to say it's good to see you, you could say, yuk e ich satini.
Yake?
Ichsatini.
Ehosatini.
Yake, yake. So those, that's a phrase you could say. Yake is another yuk-e. Good short one. That means it's good. And so there's also a lot of little things that you can learn to just use, and also the names of places. So all these places that we see in the Juneau area and in the Southeast area, they all had names. And it's so fun to learn the names of these places and to think about that renaming process. If I just walked in your house and just started giving random names to all of your family members that were in a completely different language, that would be really jarring. And if I insisted that that's what everybody call you guys now, that's what it feels like with our places, because these are the places where our language has lived for so long. And so we like to for people to say "ak" instead of "ak lake," because "ak" means little lake. You don't have to say the word lake after it because it's already there.
Ak. Cool. Well, we just have a little bit of time left. I want to get to the classes itself. Could you run through the details of those really quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. So the semester comes up next week. We have beginning Tlingit with Ishmael Hope on Monday and Wednesday evenings from 5:30 to 7:30. That runs from next week until mid-December. Intermediate Tlingit is, I'll be teaching that one Tuesday and Thursday, also 5:30 to 7:30. Then we have some Northwest Coast art classes that we're really excited about this semester. There'll be late start classes starting in October. One of them is drum making with Lyle James, which will be Fridays from 5:30 to 8:45. And then Northwest Coast design with Abel Ryan. which will be Saturdays from 12 to 3:15. And this year we're going to have our first artist in residence. It's going to be Nicholas Galanin. We're very excited. So sometime later in the semester, he'll have a public presentation, and then he's going to teach a class for us, and we're kind of working out the details of that. There's a wide variety of things that he does and can teach to folks. And this semester, we're really excited to have a zero-credit option for these classes. So these classes exist if you want to get a degree. They're built into a number of different degree programs at UAS, including a degree that focuses on Alaska Native Languages and Studies. But if you just want to learn the language, or if you just want to learn how to do some of this artwork, you could pay $75 per credit, and it ends up being about one-third the cost of the class. And then you can sit in the class. You don't get graded. It cannot apply to a degree, but it's a method we're trying to make it more accessible to folks that just want to learn.
Thank you, Lance. I got to stop you there. I'm afraid we're out of time, although this has been fascinating, and I'd love to keep going. But you've been listening to A Juno Afternoon on KTOO Juno. Thank you very much to all my guests. Thank you to the producer, Jeff Brown. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. This has been A Juno Afternoon. Have a lovely Juno evening.